From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
Our first guest this morning is UC Berkeley researcher and psychologist Dachner Keltner. There we go. He's a leading expert in human emotions. He presents his new book, Awe, The New Science of Everyday Wonder, and how it can transform your life from music to art to text to the mountains and acts that create community. Do you know what it is that inspires awe in you?
Then Park City local Kay Whiting Harrison, who bravely shares her story about surviving a suicide attempt to achieve her goal of giving hope and saving lives. She writes about it in her experience in Thriving After Suicide Attempt.
These two guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life on KPCW Park City. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
Our guest, Dachner Keltner, is a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley and the director of UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center. He's a renowned expert in the science of human emotion. And today he talks to us about the science of a not oft explored emotion, awe. A-W-E, awe. He presents a radical investigation and deeply personal inquiry into this elusive state in his new book, Awe, The New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life. Dachner Keltner, welcome to The Mountain Life.
It's great to be with you, Lynn and David. Thank you.
I was just saying to David that I'm so excited to talk to you because awe is something that I feel very often, and yeah. I've never examined it in myself or anyone else for that matter. Where did it all begin?
It began with a similar realization as what you just described, Lynn, which is that science hadn't examined awe. And I'm a scientist interested in the evolution and happiness benefits of emotions. We just hadn't really looked at it, and yet, it turns out it's all around us, right? We feel it toward nature and other people and the art and music and the like. I was just really interested in charting what is the nature of awe? How does it benefit us? How can we bring more of it into our lives during these stressful times?
Absolutely. And I think this is the key, is knowing that it's really important for us to experience awe and figure out those things that give us this physiological feeling, because there are these health benefits. So what is a health benefit from the awe I feel when I observe a lightning storm, for example?
Yeah, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson, in one of his great realizations, the great American writer, said, there's nothing that nature cannot repair. And he was having an awe experience in nature. And what we know is that when we feel awe, right, when we hear people's stories of awe, we see other people who are being courageous or kind, we see a lightning storm like you described, or like my daughter Natalie and I encountered in the High Sierras backpacking last year, it actually activates the vagus nerve, which is a big bundle of nerves that slows your heart rate, helps with blood flow and digestion. It reduces inflammation in your body. Inflammation is produced by the immune system. It's good in the short term, but bad when it's chronically activated. It can activate lower levels of cortisol, stress hormone, shifts brain chemistry. The health benefits of a dose of awe are about as strong as anything you can find. It's pretty remarkable.
With those health benefits, can you experience awe in a way of not necessarily forcing it, but like really being focused and understanding that this is a moment to recognize? Or does awe just kind of hit you in a sense when you're not even expecting it?
You know, David, that's one of the deepest questions about awe, right? There's a common notion that it just happens to me, like, you know, St. Paul on the road to Damascus, and I collapse and see God and feel awe, right? But actually, that's not true. You can go find awe intentionally, right? You can design your day to build in little moments of awe at lunch, eating outside, or going on a hike with a friend, or listening to a really important piece of music. To prove that, we did this study with Virginia Sturm, where we tested this awe walk approach, where you just go out and do a regular walk, but you look for awe, right? You find something that's mysterious and you wonder about it and you look at small things and big things. And what we found when we tested this with people who are 75 years old or older, each week they did an awe walk or another kind of walk. And over the 8 weeks, they started to feel more awe over time, right? So that tells us, David, that if we go looking for awe, it gets richer with experience. It gets deeper, more profound, which is good news, right? We don't tire of what brings us awe.
It's great news. I love not tiring of awe. Throughout my course of my life, I've often used the word awe in the sense of I'm often in awe of human talent.
Yeah.
And I've been a big athlete my whole life. And so when I'm observing other athletes doing amazing feats, you know, winning Olympic medals or breaking world records, I'm in awe of that. So is awe up to the eyes of the individual? In other words, can you find awe in anything?
You probably can, but I want to really focus on your key observation, you know, and it's actually one of the most important points, I think, in this book, awe. We surveyed people from 26 countries around the world, and we just said, write a story of awe. Tell us what was vast and mysterious that kind of blew your mind, right, that amazed you. And the most common source of awe around the world was what we call moral beauty of other people, their kindness, their courage, how they overcome obstacles, and to your observation, David, their talents, their virtuosity, a swimmer breaking a world record, right? Basketball player, Steph Curry making 88 three-pointers out of 100, et cetera. Skiers were commonly mentioned around the world. And so what that tells us is, like you said, yeah, we can find awe in almost anything. Perhaps there are probably some counterexamples, but where we can really find awe is in the people around us, right? In their qualities that inspire us, which is an important reminder these days, because you go to the news or the digital platforms and it's like, humanity is horrible. And that's not true.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Dacher Keltner, professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. He's talking about the new science of everyday wonder. It's awe. When David just brought that up, and we have awe for what other people are doing, it has made me think, okay, so in the last week, Dacher, and I know in California you've had this incredible deluge of rain. Well, we got that in snow, and it came on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. I mean, a snowstorm that we haven't seen in, you know, like decades. And that was, I was filled with wonder and awe of the snow. But even more so, it was this sense of community. You saw people going all around town, helping other people get unstuck and helping people. And it felt to me, I did get that sense of awe at this community. And I know that there's something like this that you have studied in your research. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's amazing to me. You know, America right now, as our Surgeon General Vivek Murthy has said, we're in a loneliness epidemic. You know, 30 to 40% of Americans, especially the elderly over the age of 70, feel like they don't have as much social connection as they want. And awe is an antidote to that. It really makes you feel deeply connected, right? When we feel little bursts of awe in nature, watching a snowstorm, seeing a skier, what happens in our minds is we start to feel like we're part of a community. We feel like we have strong ties to other people. We've done research showing a little moment of awe, marveling at some trees, leads people to help other individuals more, to feel less narcissistic. And that tells us in these times, especially in the United States, where people want more social connection, one of the best ways to find it is through awe, right? Through listening to music or nature or so forth. And there's even a deeper lesson here, which is when we feel awe, one of the ways we know it is we get the chills, we tear up, we get a lump in our throat, right? And those are physiological responses that also are part of our body connecting to other people, right? To feel like we're part of community. So, you know, I teach a lot of happiness in different parts of the world, and people come to me and they say, you know, my teenager is really lonely and I'm worried. And I always tell them, like, get the child outside and feeling awe, right? And it's a good pathway to social connection.
This sounds kind of corny, but it's along the same lines. And I've never known why it happens to me, but when there's an ambulance coming behind you and you see the lights and you hear the siren and everyone, you know, we go from this insular, very selfish world, how we're driving down the road and everyone pulls off. And I get that kind of lump in my throat.
Yeah.
And I've never known why. And now I know. So
that's incredible. And I love hearing people's awe stories because they're always different, right? And but yet you see some common sense, that common core to it. Like when we observe people working together, you know, like a basketball team or people working together in an emergency, we're filled with awe, right? At the human capacity to attend to people in need.
Yeah. On the cover page of your book, it says that it can transform your life. Awe can transform your life. What is the science showing about awe and what, how is it transforming lives?
It's incredible, you know, David. Right now, there's recent work around the world out of the pandemic that, you know, levels of depression and anxiety and loneliness are up 30 to 40%, right? It was just a hard time. We watched people die. We were lonely, we were isolated. And these moments of awe, everyday awe, right? Just watching a nature video or looking outside at the snow or thinking of somebody who inspires you morally, right? Who makes you have faith in humanity. They transform how you relate and look at the world, right? So we've done research, really, really rigorous research, that a little moment of awe, the daily stresses that really undermine my well-being don't feel so stressful. You know, you're like, ah, okay, I got a parking ticket, no big deal, right? You have a greater sense of time. You know, you feel like I look at my day's schedule after a little moment of awe, and I don't feel pressured anymore. I feel like I've got enough time. You have a deeper sense that you are connected to a lot of people, just from, we've talked about this. And then really interesting is that moments of awe sharpen your focus on what really matters to you, what your purpose is, right? That, and you've probably had that experience, right? You know, when I go backpacking every summer with my daughter, Natalie, I come out of it, you know, I've been in the back, I'm sore, I pulled a muscle, you know, my feet are blistered. I have the awe experience and I go back to my life and I'm like, I really know what matters to me. You know, I want to do this and I want to do that kind of research, et cetera. So it is one of these emotions that transforms how you look at the world.
You said sharpen your focus, which really struck with me. And so is experiencing awe, just, is it a different form or different way of being aware or appreciation?
Yeah, what a terrific question, right? There's all this interest right now in mindfulness, consciousness, the state of the mind. And I really believe that awe, and I'm not alone, Rene Descartes, the great philosopher, Albert Einstein, a lot of people have really come to the conclusion that a state of wonder and awe and curiosity about life is a basic form of awareness. And we can approach it, like you said earlier, you know, to almost anything in life, to raising kids, to doing my work, to working out in the afternoon, to where does my mind go when I fall asleep? Awe is a basic state of awareness. And what's really exciting is, you know, and I write about this in the book, it's pretty easy to find. You know, you just have to stop and rest and wait a little and look around for things that might amaze you, and it might come to you.
Thacker, when you talk about, you know, you bring figures from history into the conversation about awe and indigenous groups. I mean, you talk Einstein and Darwin and Whitman, and there are, when were their first sort of recorded moments of awe that you found in your research?
Yeah, thank you for bringing it up. You know, in writing this book, awe, I do some of the science that we've talked about. That's my career. I write a lot about the cultural origins of awe, that you find it in the Age of Enlightenment, and Edmund Burke and Darwin and Emerson and Margaret Fuller. But even more deep, and thank you, Lynn, for reminding us of the indigenous peoples who came before us. They have great oral traditions, different kinds of written traditions. This is 470 million people around the world. And so I consulted with a remarkable scholar named Dr. Yuria Saleedwin of the United Nations and now at the Othering and Belonging Institute at Berkeley, who really is working on how awe and transcendence is just a basic layer to indigenous cultures, to find this sense of connection and sort of transcendent feeling and connection to a spiritual force. It's just everywhere in indigenous culture. So I trace awe back beyond the written record of Western European cultures to indigenous traditions, thanks to that kind of scholarship of Dr. Saleedwin.
Yeah. It's hard to bring this up because I know that the Great Pyramids and places like Machu Picchu were built on the backs of slaves, right? Yeah. But I still think, I remember in my 20s, I went to Machu Picchu and I was in absolute awe of what they had built. And I thought that there must be some sort of inspiration that they were going forth from. Now I feel like it might be that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We always have to look at, you know, how we feel awe and question, is this good for the greater good, right? Am I being awestruck by something built by slaves, which means there was a system of slavery there? And how do we change that as culture evolves? Am I being awestruck by marches of military figures for Nazism? Well, clearly that's problematic, right? And we change that. So that's one of the real complexities of awe, is it can mislead us. As my daughter being awestruck by a guru who's going to take her away from the family and put her into a cult, right? Which was a worry in the 1970s when I was growing up. So that's part of culture, is to question the sources of awe and ask, is this good for our society? And we're always in question of that sort of thing.
In the Western culture, especially America, we really get caught up in the day-to-day and just, you know, the hustle that is our culture breeds. So what are some of the triggers? Walk us through some of the daily experiences that you have in reminding yourself to look for awe.
Yeah, thank you. You know, in some sense, in these times, we always want, you know, actionable or practical knowledge. And for our listeners, I would really recommend they go to ggia.berkeley.edu. We have 700,000 people using this website for free, which has well-being practices. And we've developed a lot of awe practices, how we find it, like you said, David, on a regular basis. What can you do? You can do an awe walk, you know, just there are thousands of people leading awe walks around the world thanks to this research I've described. Go find some awe on your regular walk. You can share awe stories. Two of my favorites are talk to a friend about an earliest experience of awe, right? Or talk to a friend or some people about where you find awe in music. So you can do that. You can get outside. You can think about a sacred text for you. Such an interesting question, right? What is a text, a writing that really just makes you feel a deep sense of purpose? So we have a lot of practices, just, you know, walking and finding awe, thinking about the moral beauty of people with some exercises, getting out in nature, obviously, so rich in Utah where you guys are, listening to music intentionally. Think of a song that makes you tear up. And go listen to that and think about why. Lots of things to do to find awe right now. And in fact, it's interesting, you know, David and Lynn, it really caught us off guard. When we did research on awe, we found people feel it 2 to 3 times a week, right? So that tells us it's there to be enjoyed.
We briefly discussed this topic, but I'm curious, can people fall into a trap of experiencing awe in a negative sense?
Yeah.
And so they're constantly in awe that this guy cut them off or this their neighbor's blowing snow into their driveway or those types of emotions.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is where our terminology is really important. And we've done a lot of good work that I report on in this book, Awe, which is, you know, awe is about vast mysteries. about a quarter of experiences of awe involve serious threat, right? So if somebody really cuts you off on the freeway and almost sends you into a 360, right, or 180, you'll feel awe, like, wow, that was really almost life-threatening. You know, I was hiking up in the Sierras with my daughter, and we got hit by a lightning storm that was, first it was awe-inspiring, and then we're like, this is dangerous, right? And so, yeah, you got to watch out for those threatening kinds of awe, because they can become horrifying and terrifying, right? So it's just important to kind of stay away from those and stay focused on these more inspiring, elevating forms.
You just a moment ago talked about awe in music and awe in a text, perhaps. And my father, when he listens to certain symphonies, he just sits there with tears running down his cheeks. Yeah. And then also I was visiting for Christmas, and we sat down and watched Scrooge, A Christmas Carol, the original, or the one, not the original one, but the one with George C. Scott. And he picked out a line, I wish I could remember it now, but it's one line in Scrooge that brings him to tears. Mm. And the thing about that it's very curious, but it also makes me know that he will never lack for inspiration or motivation to find those things in his life. And what do we say about longevity or health as we age?
And I love your example, Lynn, because it reminds us one of the sources of awe is intergenerational meaning in our lives. What are the ideas and sayings and pieces of music that really moved your parents that were part of your upbringing? You know, for me, it was the Beatles. You know, I listened to the Beatles with my parents, and even listening to, you know, Within You, Without You of Sgt. Pepper's today, you know, 50 years later, it brings me goosebumps, tears, and a sense of the awe of, this is my family. This is what we care about, right? And I really encourage people, you know, especially in the holidays, to be thinking intergenerationally and the awe of time, that there are things that our parents cared about, that we care about, that really unite us in a sense of awe.
Yeah. In a couple of weeks, we have, as we do each year, the Sundance Film Festival here in our town. And maybe you've been here before.
I haven't.
Glad to get back to, you know, a normal film festival this year after a couple of years where it wasn't normal at all. Yeah. And I think it also produces this sense of awe at the creativity. And I just make that comment because it helps explain why so many people flock to this town to observe it, right?
Yeah, this is back to one of our main sources of awe that David sort of brought us to, which is just, you know, being awestruck at the human capacity, right, for creation, for doing new things, for new visual forms, to films and music. And, you know, it is our defining strength in some sense, our creativity. And isn't it amazing that we have this emotion that tells us this kind of creativity will always bring you life and energy and good health?
Well, the book is Awe, the New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life. Our guest is Dacher Keltner. We're so glad you could join us, and bravo for writing this book and doing the research you do.
Thank you, Lynn and David. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you, Dacher.
Yeah. Take care, you guys.
And we will be back after these words. You're listening to The Mountain Life on KPCW Park City. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
Our next guest is a wife, a mother, a grandmother, a sister, skier, hiker, biker, and she is also a suicide attempt survivor. In Kay Whiting Harrison's words, she not only survived, but she now lives, thrives, and finds joy almost every day. She very bravely shares her story and her new book with us today. The book is Lived to Tell, Thriving After Suicide Attempt. Kay Whiting Harrison, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, we really appreciate that you're sharing this story, and we appreciate how much you telling your story adds to the destigmatization of talking about suicide, of talking about mental health challenges. So thank you for that. Tell us why you decided to start sharing.
I started writing many years ago. I've always kept a journal, but the day I almost died, my son said to his wife, "I know she's going to live and she's going to write." So for his 30th birthday, he said, "I want 50 pages of your story, Mom." So I started writing. I didn't like what I was writing, but I wrote it anyway, and did not have a full 50 pages for him for his 30th birthday. I met some incredible people here in Park City. Lana and Rob Youngberg introduced me to the mental illness nonprofit Connect. And by doing so, I was accepted into Park City. And I found a group of people that accepted me. And I and my husband totally hid my mental illness. After I met Lynn and Andrew Tan is when I really started to write, because I knew that because other people had accepted me, it gave so much healing to me that I decided I was going to write, and eventually started writing the book with an end intention of telling my story. So it started with my son, and then the acceptance of those in Connect Summit County really opened my life up and my eyes to how much mental illness that there is. And hopefully I could help others that were really struggling.
Well, Connect Summit County is an amazing group. I think that it has really helped, you know, just talking about mental wellness and talking about how to get there and how to surmount those mental health challenges and not be ashamed of them. Because as you say, so many people, you know, have challenges. And it seems to me that we all try to live this balance between, you know, put on a happy face and fake it till you make it, or really coming out to the people that we love, but not trying to overburden them with the issues that we're having in our lives. And you were one of those people that was going to put on the happy face to the nth degree. Can you share with us why you strove for that happy face and the perfection?
Well, in general, I am a really happy person. I always look like I'm happy, and I wanted to portray that. I was working in three hospitals in hospital management as a physician relations manager in Southern California. And the job was really intense, and I loved working with the doctors. So I needed to be on my game all of the time. The intensity became, I mean, it just increased more and more all of the time, to the point where the day before I almost died, I was in the hospital in my business suit, smiling, and I was literally dying on the inside. I was living in a real deep, dark hole that I could not portray anything differently. And I was determined to continue. Not even my best friends knew anything, my closest friends. And Lex was very respectful of me. Lex is my husband. He was very respectful and didn't feel like he could talk to anyone about it either. This was a really big error, because talking about it is healing. Not talking about it makes it so much harder. And yet, it's not just stigma that we're dealing with, it's discrimination. If the people in my hospital, if my directors had known that, I'm not sure I would have been able to keep my job. I think they would have worked around that, and I was very fearful of losing my job.
You mentioned that some of your closest friends didn't even know that you were depressed or in this situation, or even at that point of your attempt. And I unfortunately have had three friends that I've lost to suicide. And it brings back the point of, could we have done something more? Could we have known? And, you know, one of the three we knew was depressed, and it was a couple attempts before he finally took his life. But as a friend, as a peer, as a family member, how can you help the individual in understanding what they're going through, and how can you help them find a path to hopefully get out of this?
You know, that's a great question, because I am a certified peer support specialist, and in the last year, I've had the opportunity of being with people that were in really bad situations and very depressed. People are very afraid of these questions because they are so afraid they're going to plant ideas in their heads, people that are struggling. As a peer support, we are trained, and it's been proven over the past many years, that when you are with a person that might be suicidal or you don't know, you ask the questions. Don't, you know, run around those questions, but you ask specifically, are you hurting right now? And whatever they say. And in my cases, the women, and there were several women on separate occasions, were you hurt? Are you hurting? Yes. Are you wanting to die? Yes. Do you have a plan? Yes. And that is when you call in the authorities. Well, not the authorities, but you call MCOT, and we do have an MCOT team here in Park City, and that's Mobile Crisis Outreach Team. And they are also peer support specialists, and they can come in, and they are trained to deal with the crisis that's going on right now. But unfortunately, well, let me just say this. Fortunately, when you ask those questions, it opens the door for those people to finally go, oh my gosh, you're getting it. You understand. Not everyone will be honest. But in the cases where I was with that person, they were honest, and I was able to call MCOT or emergency or get them to the hospital. Those questions are really critical. And unfortunately, I really believe people are afraid of this, and we're not planting. If someone had asked me that, other than my own husband, it opens those doors of, oh my gosh, yes, I am. I'm hurting more emotionally. Sometimes people have been cutting, or they've hurt themselves intentionally. So those questions need to be asked.
Once those questions are asked, and the individual has reached a place of, we'll call it awareness of, and you know, openness, that they're out with their hurt, what are, for you, what are the steps that, I'm sure it's a daily journey to continue to be more excited about life than feeling that you know it's easier to not live than to live. And so what are the daily journals or daily journeys that you're doing, whether it's through exercise or nature or friends or books, or what are certain things that you're continuing to do your journey that others can do as well?
I need a support team, and I have and in my book I talk about Bobbi Fosburgh, that's here in Park City, and she's an incredible therapist. And I hung on to her coattails of hope for a long time, for the first couple of years that I was here. All of us that have been into that deep, dark rabbit hole, we need hope that there is something better than what we're actually going through right now. And that is really tough sometimes when we're in such darkness. And unless someone has had, you know, depression or anxiety, or they're going through some other kind of mental illness, it's hard to understand that there's, in our minds, there's no hope left. What has happened is that the mental illness hijacks our brain, and it's very difficult. It was for me anyway, that I have an incredible family, supportive family, and extended families. The brain is so hijacked, I could not feel love from anyone. I couldn't feel any hope. And so by having a good therapist, good medication, and some people choose not to do medication, that's okay. But find something that will work so that your brain is not hijacked so badly, and people can give you signs of hope. It's imperative. And I was reading about hope last night again, and everyone needs to have hope that there's a better day. So my husband, my children, my grandchildren, I saw that as a lot of hope. And once the medication is helpful and it kicks in, the light really becomes, you can see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Hmm. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Kay Whiting Harrison. Her new book is Lived to Tell, Thriving After Suicide Attempt. She's a Park City resident, and she's sharing her story with us today. Kay, I'm wondering, I also have had people close to me die by suicide, and there's always that question in my mind, I mean, among many other questions, whether or not it is not a momentary thing, but of this very short time period, that if you can just get past that time period, you might get past the attempt. I had a friend of a friend who died by suicide, and my friend kept saying, I know he wasn't planning it because he bought new bike shoes just the day before. So I know he wasn't planning it. And that question sort of resides in my psyche somewhere. Like, if you can just get them, you know, or yourself, and say, this too shall pass, what does that look like?
Oh gosh, Lynn, that's a tough question. What does it look like when someone doesn't look like it was planned?
Well, let me ask you this. In your case, in reading about your attempt, you had been building to this point, and that it was sort of like this last stage that you broke through that made you suddenly grab a handful of pills and devour them. And it was almost as if you could have made it past that point because it was so sudden and it was so immediate. And I felt like maybe you didn't really have a plan, that it was almost like a crime of passion, that it was this instantaneous thing.
No.
Okay.
It 6 months had been building up to it. And the I think a common denominator with people that try to die by suicide is exhaustion. Mm-hmm. We have just, you know, pushed forward more and more and more. And I was totally exhausted for 6 months. The night before, I came home from work and walked for a long time. I just crumbled down into a ball down in a riverbed where it was very quiet and very private. And I pleaded for some help. And again, my brain was so hijacked. I couldn't find a way out. And if someone had said, do you have a plan? Do you want to die? I would have said yes. I would have said yes. I want to die. So I didn't have a plan, a real plan, until the next morning. And it's different for every person. Kevin Hines, who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, when he jumped, he said, because he survived, he said, I really regretted that. It was a mistake. As I took the pills, started writing a note to my family, it was pure relief. But what a huge mistake. And my husband and I both now say, I wish he had packed me up and taken me to the hospital. And then I was already under treatment with a psychiatrist, but I was just so exhausted. I couldn't see any hope. So I think as a person or a friend or a loved one, open up that discussion with that person. Someone that's in this state of mind, even really healthy people, we all need to be listened to, acknowledged, and heard. I just needed to be heard. Even though my husband tried, I knew he was exhausted of trying to get me over difficult barriers. And so that's when I retreated in and I thought, he just doesn't need this anymore. And I honestly can say, because our minds are hijacked, I knew in my own mind, my very, very ill mind, that my husband, my family, my children, everyone would be better off without me. And so the dialogues are important. And then when that person who is struggling can talk without being interrupted, even though we're irrational, we need to be listened to and heard and acknowledged. It's very, very critical for someone that is struggling.
What about this younger generation? There's a lot of studies that I've just, you know, heard through the grapevine, and that this generation nowadays, there's more people depressed than ever. And a lot of that had to do with the pandemic, and a lot of that has to do with the immediate social media, the gratification of seeing people that maybe have more than you, and you have a feeling of less than, if you will. And for these younger generation, you know, teenage type individuals or even younger, that don't fully have an awareness of the scope of what they're stressing about, how does a parent cope with that? And how do they help the child through these times when they don't really have another perspective of the world?
I think as a parent, I'm going to go back again, that the parent needs to have an open communication. Even as young adults, I have heard them say that the parents will say, well, get outside, go work out more, go with your friends, but, you know, keep going. Instead of having that dialogue with them, I think as a parent, we need to be very, very aware of any patterns that are being changed in a child or a teenager's life, that we become aware, but we open that communication. And if, especially if a kid or a teenager is not being listened to, we're gonna miss those opportunities. I was visiting with one young man. He was older than 20, but his father was a psychologist. And his father would say, go to the gym, you're fine. He could not accept the fact that his own son was really struggling with a very severe depression. And the father, you would have thought, would have opened up and really listened and helped his son, but it was, you got to get out of the house and go exercise. So the same, we just don't listen. And there's a program that there's several of us, including Lynn Rutan, that we teach, and it's called LEAP. And there's a book called I Am Not Sick, I Don't Need Help. But the communication is listen, empathize, agree, and partner. Even though we have to agree to disagree sometimes, those four steps are very, very critical. Lex and I use those with each other, is that we listen and we empathize, agree, and partner. Those are so critical. And as a society, we just want to talk all of the time instead of listen to what's going on.
You mentioned that a lot of your identity was tied to your self-worth was tied to your net worth and the amount of money you were making. And I'm curious, now that you're in a life of service and giving back, is this new identity you're essentially tying yourself to, as we all have an identity we're tied to in a way, is giving back in the service helping you grow? And what is the future for you as far as it, you know, in your journey, Kay? How are you moving forward in this life of yours?
Oh, thanks for asking that. Writing, and I've been asked many times if writing the book was healing or was it really tough? And yes, it was very tough, but the healing, and that's why journals are so important. The book was incredibly healing. And by doing so, and by being able to visit with other people who are struggling with loved ones, or the people that are struggling themselves, is healing. And now that the book is out and it's doing well, that's my goal. That's my going forward goal, is that I can reach out to people, or I would hope someone or people would reach out to me. I had a friend say shortly after I was out of the hospitals, he said, if you can save one life, this will be worth it. So in 2019, I started speaking to groups, organizations, nonprofits, churches, and the more I can speak, the more I would like to talk to those people and see if I couldn't give them a little bit of hope and help, because that's so critical in finding that hope. So yes, going forward, it's all, I want to be of service to others.
And that's also part of your therapy, Kay. I'm curious, do you know at this point that you will never attempt suicide again?
I don't think we can ever say never, but I will tell you that in the book, and I think you read that, Lynn, that a friend of mine asked me toward the end of writing the book, she said, can I ask you a personal question? And I said, of course, I'm an open book. And she said, do you ever have suicidal ideations anymore? And I said, no. She asked, why not? And I had to think about that for a little bit. And I think it's because I know that I have a good therapist, and that's hard to find, but it's critical. I am 100% compliant on my medication. I'm active outdoors. Sometimes it's still hard getting up in the morning. You know, I think everyone has tough days. I am still triggered. And I, to those loved ones that can trigger me, I have to explain to them why it triggers me. And so they're mindful of that too. And my husband is very mindful. I do my very best every day. And I do a lot of meditation, a lot of prayer. I'm still skiing, I'm active. And for me, that's critical. But that's the post-recovery. I was in a psychiatric hospital. That was one of the hardest things I've ever done, but it was one of the best things I've ever done too in my recovery. So it is helping that person and everyone. It's so individual, but I really want to help people find that hope. This is a difficult road, and it's so prevalent now. I don't even know how high the statistics of suicide are. But the one thing I wanted to thank you both is that instead of saying committed suicide, we really try to use the term died by suicide. Committed suicide just seems pretty harsh, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And so we use the term died by suicide or tried to die by suicide. Did that answer your question, Lynn? Mm-hmm.
Yes, it did. Absolutely. I think that it's quite prevalent, this hesitation to talk about suicide, because, I mean, your story was perfect about the psychologist who didn't even want to address it with his own son. We tend to focus on the positive. My two kids are in their 20s, and when we talk about how their lives are going, we do want to focus on the positive. You know, how's your job? And, oh, what do you like about doing this? And how's this project going? And how's your relationship? And, you know, maybe there's something as a parent, as a friend, as a family member, we do want to help focus on the positive. And I know so many people are scared to even bring up that word suicide, because they believe that the more you talk about it, the more it implants the idea into someone's head, especially if they are unwell.
Right.
What kind of coaching can you give us about that, that would just say, no, you've got to talk about it?
Well, again, I think we're going back to asking the right questions without even going to the word suicide. With people that I don't even know really well, I will look them in the eye and make sure that I have eye contact with them and say, how are you really doing? You know, what's going on, or what are you doing? It has to be so sincere that a person trusts you and what you're going to tell them will be heard. Again, it's about listening. And if they're not willing to talk right now, open up the dialogue for a later time. but they need to trust you. They need to know that you're being honest with them. And you're right about being, we want to be positive. We want to, you know, think positively. It just does not work for someone that is struggling with depression or anything else. It's that trust and being heard. So instead of always going, oh, it, you know, everything is so great, everything's so positive, make sure that you go to the inner of these conversations rather than just keeping a positive surface, because that's what kept me into a very negative, happy face surface.
Yes. Well, I feel like we could go on talking with you all morning, but we're out of time. I just want to leave with this comment. I quite recently had a friend die by suicide, and mm-hmm. afterwards, as everyone does, you, like, yeah. David said, you all wonder what you could have done, what you could have said. And it made me think about the people in my life who I might worry about. And I did call one of those people that I've worried about, and I've said, and I said it, you know, and it was new for me. I said, have you ever considered suicide? And he said to me, no, I would never do that. I will tell you that now. I will never do that. It made me feel, well, such relief, of course. And it was the positive thing that I was looking for. And maybe right. I should have said, well, never say never. But, you know, it made me so happy that I asked the question.
Oh, absolutely. And it was simple, right?
Yeah, it was simple.
Very, very simple. So, yes. Open the dialogue, and I mean, what a beautiful gift you gave to him.
Well, I hope so.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. And I just want to put a shout out to Dolly's. The book is at Dolly's. They were wonderful to work with for the book signing, and it's also on Amazon, but Dolly's has just been wonderful. Yeah.
Yes. That's Dolly's bookstore located on Main Street, Park City. Kay Whiting Harrison, her book is Live to Tell, Thriving After Suicide Attempt. Thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life, Kay.
Thanks for having me.